Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 21st, 2021, and welcome to episode 246 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
TRCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and hordes of data. I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston, and I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you? How's it going?
Excellent. I am not near Boston. You can look out that window and see. Yeah, no Boston. Yep.
Very cool. Also joining us from Stockholm is Jack Nutting. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Even farther from Boston.
Because how much Boston can you see?
Yeah. None ever. There's never anything like a straight line going through air between here and Boston.
Yeah.
No, tunnel. But I'm good. I feel like it's been forever since I've been on the podcast. I think it's been like maybe a half a year or something. It's just been a long time. It's been busy.
Yeah.
Busy times, but good. Good busy, so it's good.
Well, it's also like 9 p.m. there right now, too.
Right. Yeah. So. And like most of the time, typically it's been 10 p.m. when we start, and then it's like, I'm getting old and tired. I need to go to bed on Sunday night.
Yeah, that's the advantage of age, right?
Yep. But, I guess.
Yeah. I still haven't quite gotten away from that. You know, like if I'm doing something, you know, there's just a little bit more farther I can get, you know, and so then it winds up being 2 a.m.
Yeah.
What's really annoying.
Happens to me. I was up doing a presentation for work on Thursday night. I think I was up until 2 a.m. then also. Just because I was having fun and I was using Keynote and I was like animating things and doing all this stuff. And it's like, it's pretty fun and like you do a cool thing and it's like, okay, I spent 5 hours working on this presentation that I then rush through in 10 minutes because I'm limited time when I'm actually giving it. It's like, okay, maybe this didn't need to be 5 hours, but it was
possible.
Fun. It was good. I enjoyed it, so hey.
Yeah, one effect I do see though with myself, at least when I'm doing this, like you know, I've got a relatively large mundane task to do, like scanning something or whatever. I'm working on it.
Hmm.
I can get a little bit further, looking at it a little bit further, and then suddenly I wake up like you know an hour's gone by and I dozed off in front of my like scan. It's like all right, well that wasn't worth it.
Oops.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so. The host's topic today, came from a listener feedback that we got from listener Bob, who linked to an article that is published it's a Wired article, Wired.co.uk, on basically privacy and data and retro computing data preservation. The title of the article is Retro Collectors Are Uncovering Hordes of Old Data.
Hordes!
And it has turned out that a third of us have read this a week ago. A third of us have skimmed it a week ago. A third of us skimmed it a couple minutes ago.
Is a big way to say one.
Nevertheless, it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting topic, and I think we probably have you know things we can say about it even without the article. it's an interesting idea, and I look forward to reading the article. But Jack, you said. Jack, you were the third who read it a while
yes.
ago.
Yes, I'm the third who actually read it before we even had in our show notes to talk about it.
Yeah.
I read this.
Very cool.
Yeah, and so it's basically, I mean, it's a series of anecdotes. They spoke with someone called Sean Malseed. Mm. They say Sean Malseed is a high-profile figure in the retro computing community. He has a YouTube channel called Action Retro, and he has nearly 30,000 subscribers. That's That's more high profile than us, I would say.
I would. By many thousands.
Yeah, by by a couple of a couple of zeros. So the gist of the article is that more and more people are, as people are collecting retro computers that are, you know, a little bit newer vintage, they're getting things that have hard drives in them that just like fire up and still work. And there suddenly you find people's tax records, people's medical records. Like for me, all the stuff that I'm looking at is old, you know, pre hard drive era Atari 8-bit stuff mostly. Like, I guess in theory I could come across somebody's floppy disks that have some stuff on them, but chances are I wouldn't even look at them. But if you get a late 80s Mac with a built-in hard drive and you power it up, you're going to see what's right there. So, yeah. And there were a few anecdotes in here about like trying to contact people and if you can identify who they are and, you know, get a hold of them. And yeah, just a few, it's interesting sort of stories here, the kind of stuff that we tend to talk about also. Mm-hmm. They should have asked us for input.
Yeah, with our dozens of, followers on YouTube or whatever.
We are low profile.
Yeah, that's right. Low profile figures in the retro computing community.
Yeah. Flying under the radar.
Yeah, I mean, I think even, I have definitely this instinct to just image everything. You know, like I've got, and I have a few times, you know, I've gone out and gotten a lot of things, you know, like a lot, you know, as in,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like yeah. This is being sold as a lot.
Lot.
Yeah. And you know, there'll be a box and, there's like 30, whatever Word Perfect discs or whatever. It's just got like letters or memos or, you know, I don't think I've ever seen anything like a, you know, itemized list of, you know, drug transactions or whatever, but, but certainly
people
taxes.
Killed.
Yeah. In a couple of cases, it's basically like, someone was, you know, someone's parents passed away and they're sort of like clearing out the attic or whatever. And, you know, here's the stuff. And, and there, that does sort of, you do kind of wonder, you know, like I have the equipment to resurrect this stuff. I can get the stuff off the floppies that they couldn't. Maybe they had just the floppies and not the machine. That's often the case. So the question is, do they want that last letter that you know their father wrote to somebody? And yeah, I don't know how you make that call. And you know, the other thing is like, it's a little, do you read it? I mean, like, you know, do you identify what it is? It's tricky.
Right. Like, I mean, certainly there shouldn't be any obligation on you as the buyer to like spend a lot of time thinking about it and deciding and like, you know, making, because they're like, sure, there is like there's a thought that there could be something important in there, right? There could be something important there that for the deceased loved ones is either heartwarming and nice or like terrifying and life destroying. Like, you don't know what's going to be on someone's, you know, stuff, right? So it's like, you could be like, you could very much be the bearer of bad news. Like, these seem to be all of your late husband's, all of his, a bunch of Word documents. Here, they're all online for you. They're on this Google Drive.
Right. Oh, look at like, all that hidden finance, or you know,
right? They learn about his second hidden family and whatever, and just like,
right.
Here's a location of my real will. She's like, who's Carol?
Yeah. So I suppose there are situations where that may be quite unwelcome. It seems like really the, probably the right move there is just to consider these to be blank disks, consider them to be lost. But,
right.
You know, you could imagine like some lost poem or something that, that grandpa wrote that they'd really love to have, you know, so.
Right. Yeah. And there have also been, apart from the personal connection, there also have been situations where someone turned out to be an incredible artist or incredible writer, completely unsung during their time. And then after their death, these things that they wrote are discovered and like, you know, become a hugely popular thing. Right. I remember there was something, unfortunately I don't recall her name. There was a woman who was a photographer taking a ton of photos mostly in New York City. And I think she was like working as a nanny or something like that. She was like working as in somebody's household and taking tons of photos. And like after, you know, after her, she had passed, someone came across these and realized this was an incredible photographer. And like they've been, you know, published and exhibitions and all this kind of thing. Now you're probably not going to discover that on a bunch of WordPerfect discs.
No,
but you never know.
Quick take 100s.
Yeah.
I think this is a bigger problem for more modern computers than retro things, because with retro, old hard drives, like it says in the article, now that I've read the article, with older hard drives and with floppy disks, it's much easier to erase them. With modern SSDs, it really resists writing over the data because you have a limited number of times you can do that. So you'll say erase it, and it'll go, I will just mark it as having been erased and pretend I don't know about it. But it doesn't actually get rid of it. Even if you try to write over a thing, it'll resist and want to write to a different sector. It's very difficult to actually erase an SSD, much more difficult than you'd think. So I think this will be a bigger issue for current computers when they become retro computers and get passed on, because I don't think a lot of people realize that it is a fundamental difference between old things and modern solid state drives.
Yeah.
So go retro computers.
Yeah.
For the longest time, I've always dealt with this. Whenever I've passed on old computers, I have always removed the hard drives, totally destroyed them, maybe put another drive in if I'm selling the computer, or if I'm just recycling whatever, it just goes to the recycler with no hard drive. I have a metal fabrication shop my family has, and so I use an iron worker to punch giant holes through it. So physically I destroy the hard drives, and I've done that for all my family's computers, my old computers, all our work computers. It's always been my policy to physically destroy the hard drive, because I just don't trust erasing.
But then, you know,
have any of you ever encountered this yourself? Have you ever gone to a garage sale or got out something off eBay and found somebody's treasure trove of goodies?
Yeah. I mean, like I have a ton of like business records, you know, from this company that this family ran, you know, and all sorts of, you know, memos to the advertising, you know, the places where they were putting advertising and all this kind of stuff. And you know, also discs of like letters to people and things like that. And I haven't sat down to read them, and you know, I don't really feel like I should exactly, but I know they're there. You know,
I wonder what the legality is. Like, could you put up a website that published these things? Like, if they were thrown away, does that turn them into public domain? Like, you're allowed to go through somebody's garbage? Does it count as garbage just because it's digital, or you don't have the right to publish it? Like, I wonder where.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I'd feel comfortable doing it anyway, but
isn't it the case that like anything you create, there is an implicit copyright on, even if you don't register it and file it? So like
but for business records, is there a copyright on those? Does that count as,
I don't know.
Is it literally anything you create? I don't know.
I do kind of wonder though, in a way, like probably nothing that I have in my possession, but I mean, like you could imagine such a thing, you know, triggering a lawsuit. When somebody looks at it and says, wait, you said you only made half that much, you know, or whatever.
That'd be fun.
That would be exciting.
Do it, Paul. Yeah. Do it.
See how many lives you can destroy with this topic.
Yeah. Destroying lives. RCR way.
Impact one way or the other. Doesn't matter. But yeah, I don't know.
I feel like I have heard Kay Savitz mention a few times that, you know, when he's talked to somebody who was developing software 30 or 40 years ago, and they're like, oh, yeah, I've got all this stuff, but I don't know what to do with it. And they, like, send him their disks and stuff, and he can sort of read it all in and pass it back to them in some form. And people seem to be universally happy about that. But then that's people who, they have something they're keeping, and they know there's something valuable on it. Like, they know there is source code or whatever, and they just, like, don't know how to get it out. It's different than if you are just acquiring something at a garage sale or something, and you've managed to figure out who it belonged to.
Right. I mean, like in some of these cases, you know, the person who's selling it doesn't actually know the person who originally, you know, wrote these things.
Right.
Yeah. And so like you could do a little like stalkery exercise and find them and say like, hey, you know, I found this stuff. And it sounds actually, you know, like when I say it that way, it sounds sort of like those, you know, the spam emails you get about like, hey, you know, I've guess what? I've been in your computer. It's like, yeah, I'm sure you have. But I mean, you know, this is like the real life version of that. It's like,
right.
I have all your old stuff.
I'm more tempted to, whenever I have an old computer, truly erase it and then fill it with a bunch of false things that look really salacious, and then send that out for recycling, and just to see if that ever pops up again, like a little message in a bottle, see what happens.
That seems cool. Yeah. I mean, I guess one from an archiving standpoint, I'm not sure I am all that happy with the idea of punching the drives out, you know, and getting rid of the you know, all your personal documents and the last copy of you know, whatever the calendar program for the Lisa or whatever, you know.
right.
But so that's always, you know, that's always sort of the hope, is that in amongst the junk, there's like a copy of something that that the original author lost or something, you know. But yeah, anyway, it's definitely something that the further away you get from the people who wrote the stuff, the kind of bigger this becomes. Because I mean, like, nobody today can get stuff off these drives or these floppies, you know. So,
and the further you get from it, the more interesting I would find it, I think, because I'm drawn to retro computers. But the reality is, if I find somebody's homework from last year, I don't care. But if I find somebody's simple banner in print shop, I'm going to be really interested. Hey, look, they made a print shop banner. I will just be interested in just because of its era. So,
right.
I think that, but I don't know if that's inherently the case because something's older, just because I'm into old computers.
Yeah.
Another thing the article I found interesting was he was saying how up till before the pandemic, being a recycler, one of the people mentioned in the article was a recycler. He said, stop sending me the plastic MacBooks, the polycarbonate MacBooks, he referred to it, because they had no value. And then during the pandemic, the last couple of years, they've now had a resurgence and they're worth, you know, $100 to $300 each from being worth nothing. And I don't think that's a pandemic thing so much as that is the natural life cycle of computers, where they get nothing, goes down to, and then eventually it's like, oh, I remember when, and it starts rising in value again.
So. Right.
Yeah. And a wave of people think, oh, why did I not buy this 3 years ago?
Right. When it was nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's true that this is not a really good area for speculation, but nevertheless, there are occasional things that really do jump up in value.
Well, and like when it comes to the actual data, there was that whole story a few years ago, or was it just 1 year ago? Gosh, time has flown by. Hunter Biden's laptop, you know, that whole thing about allegedly that, you know, he left this thing in for repair, and there were allegedly documents proving something or other, but like who knows? Like, it doesn't seem like it ever amounted to anything. It seemed to never pan out to anything, but it certainly could happen. You know, and just like Carrington is saying, the more that we have modern computers with SSDs that, like you said, don't really erase well, you know, it seems like it's only a matter of time before someone who is like an important business person or someone in politics or whatever leaves a laptop, and then someone else picks it up, and like the file system is probably trashed, right? Like, you can't really, there's not a directory structure to browse, but the data is there. Someone can analyze it and, you know, forensic data analysis, figure out what the interesting parts are and find stuff.
Yeah.
We seem to be in a sweet spot of technology where computers are literally impossible to erase, and yet my family can almost constantly lose data. So it's funny how, you know, just like, don't know how that works, but somehow.
Yeah, that's true. It should be from the you know, from this difficulty of erasing things on SSDs that it should be harder and harder to lose your work, and yet
maybe that's the best way to erase a computer. Just like hand it to my sister for 30 seconds, bring it back, everything's gone. All gone. Somehow even the remote backups gone.
This could be a new service, Carrington, that your family's business could offer.
She may be magnetized. Maybe something else going on.
Excellent. I don't think I have you know, many other sort of like stories of this, but at the same time, I have large piles of discs that I have yet to go through. I mean, like, I'm sort of starting to do that now. But and most of the stuff I'm thinking about is all on floppies, you know. So, but I mean, like, when you're talking about a text document, you know, there can be all kinds of incriminating stuff in there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, I think in this article, a fair amount was made of like medical documents and, you know,
that kind of
thing. But
my dance partner, former dance partner, worked in a hospital or hospital network in privacy and data privacy. Like, that's what she did. She was one of the people that oversaw the methods they would use and making sure that people were giving informed consent. With long conversations where she explained to me what informed consent is. It's so really complicated. I'm like, oh my goodness. I thought it was really easy. Let's just get somebody to sign something. And would constantly talk about that, like the need to archive data because they have to prove that they did something properly and they got consent and all that. And at the same time, make sure that nobody who's not supposed to see it ever can possibly see it. And those things are often at odds with each other. And then I would learn about how all hospitals have near constant data leaks. And it just doesn't give me fun. But it's just like, yep, every hospital is constantly leaking everything about you. I'm like, oh, okay.
That's cool.
Great. She also said that people go into her industry 2A1, every single person she's ever worked with, currently works with, has ever worked with, are all people who are really interested in other people's private information. Because you only go into this because it's really appealing. I was like, that's kind of creepy, but okay. So,
yeah.
There you go, hospital people.
Yeah, I know in a lot of studies and things, the way you do this is always through some sort of intermediate key. You know, like so. All the sort of actual information is you know, keyed to patient number or something, and the thing that's locked away is who patient number something is. But you know, many things in that are recorded on 5 1/4-inch floppy are not particularly well protected. You know, they might have a. I must have talked about this before, but my answering machine back when I was, you know, in high school, 1980s, if you wanted to hear your messages, you would call and you would type in a 2-digit code. And the thing is, there aren't very many 2-digit codes that you can actually possibly use. So it's, somebody had worked out a number that you could type. It's, you know, it's not super long, but it's, you know, it's relatively long that would get all the number combinations because right. The thing would just listen for those two things in sequence. It wouldn't say, you know, I have heard two numbers and they are the wrong ones. I will hang up now. It just listens until it hears the right sequence. So if you just dial this big long string, you're guaranteed in on anyone's phone. Very cool.
Awesome.
Oops. Yeah, I think that actually, that trick can still work for like doors that have a 4-digit code on them.
Ah, nice.
Someone was telling me the same exact thing that someone has worked out. There is a very long sequence of numbers that you can type that like is the optimal way to actually test every single possible, you know, permutation of four numbers. And so like in theory, if you're someone who's capable of measuring a few hundred or a few thousand digits, you could break it to any, you know, any 4-digit code door by just going up and typing the thing until you get it.
Yep. Or unscrew the hinge.
or break the door.
Yeah.
So those people that memorize pi to so many digits, because there's probably a particular segment of pi that is that number. So they're, just, they're pretending that, but really they know start after this section. Open any door.
Right.
Sneaky pi people.
Is it sneaky pi? Is that the term of endearment?
In Canada, yes.
Yeah, okay.
You're either a hoser or a sneaky pi.
Anyway, yeah. I'm not sure what else we should say about this. Is there more that we should talk about? Any strategies we should pursue? I don't know. Nope.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Nope. Just assume everything you ever type will be public.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that that all holds of just modern stuff too.
And increasingly, people aren't going to have data storage on their computers anyway. It's all going to be in the cloud.
Right.
Which is really just a computer at Paul's house. I don't know why people don't realize that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, my sister had like little stickers that said something like, you know, the cloud is just somebody else's computer.
Right. Yep.
But
and this is somebody else's sticker.
Yeah. I suppose the reason this comes up, all this privacy stuff and the retro collecting, is just that this is the area where people are sort of like intentionally accumulating other people's hard drives and other people's disks and stuff. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I think I think the point about things being in the cloud is kind of interesting in the sense that like for my work, okay, I have source code on my computer, but otherwise all email, all documents of all kinds is just stuff in Google. And I remember that my employer's previous owner, a different company, like they had a big thing a while ago where they're like, oh, we want to like secure everyone's computers and make sure people don't, you know, have like their don't have Word documents that containing sensitive data in a directory that is unlocked or whatever. And it's like, but we don't have Word documents. We only have Google documents, Google spreadsheets that, you know, the only the only trace of that on my computer would be in a JavaScript accessible cache in the browser. Like, that's it. There's no, those documents don't exist on my computer otherwise.
Yeah.
And they did not, they were not swayed by this, that company.
It is weird, that kind of idea that this document isn't anywhere. Like, you can sort of print a copy of it for yourself if you want, or maybe right. download it in a different exported format. But it just doesn't exist in any way that we're familiar with.
Right.
But people went all in on it. I mean, like, you know, Google Docs is Google Spreadsheets. You know, that is just like, it's what everybody uses.
Yep.
And this, you know, how do you back it up? I don't know.
You don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the problem that I'm concerned about is, like, I get worried about making Google Spreadsheets or documents that I'm sharing with people on my team. And it's like, okay, what if somebody just goes in there and accidentally select all, hit backspace, and just deletes the whole thing? There's no sort of, if there's versioning on that stuff, I have not discovered this feature. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I know in Google Docs, you can turn on like this history, just like you can in Microsoft Word. Okay. But if that's not turned on, then you don't have it, I guess.
Cool. Yeah.
Good times.
A super long standing thing. I mean, like, the long enough standing that they probably will never change this, is that in Google Docs, you have this little chat sidebar that you can go into and you can type to people. But if you close it and come back, all that's gone. Like, you right. can't see, like, it doesn't live anywhere.
Yeah. There's no history. It's only live chat.
Yeah. Which is super annoying because often there's something useful in that window.
Oh, in the chat, Mr. Allen asked if, because we were talking about how difficult it is to erase SSDs, asked Derek Sputnik, says, so Derek Sputnik, does it work on SSDs? That is correct. It does not. It cannot tell you're on an SSD. It will not erase an SSD. And in fact, I double checked when did a quick search, and yeah, it doesn't. It can't tell you it is one, and it won't erase it. So it'll tell you it's empty, but it won't actually be erased.
What is this boot nuke? I'm not familiar with it.
DBAN, it's just a popular thing to do. It's a quick, free data, like, eraser.
Okay.
It's very popular. A lot of people use DBAN. I don't.
Because it doesn't work.
Because it doesn't work. Yeah, I think so. There's CC Cleaner as well, which also doesn't work on SSDs. Like, most of the very popular ones don't. Most enterprise erasers will, but I don't know of a free one of those.
Okay. So seriously, if you wrote random, like, if you have a 1 terabyte SSD,
you
and you wrote a random,
actually erase it.
Yeah,
yeah. You have to completely. You have to write a multiple of the size of the drive.
Yeah.
Because if you've got half the drive full and you go to erase it, and you're writing things, it'll intentionally always write to other places.
Right.
And it doesn't want to. Even the most recently, it's trying to equal out the writes. But if you write enough long term, yes. But most things don't do that, because if something erases an SSD really, really quickly, it did not erase an SSD.
Yeah.
So it's one way to know. If it spends a whole bunch of time doing it, then maybe. Or it's just really inefficient and written by me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, yeah. So I guess we've probably explored most of the corners of the data hoarding.
I like how it was an article mostly about ethics, and we barely touched on that. We're like, ethics, whatever, publish it all.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, like, you have to. You have to read it before you know. I guess that's. I was thinking you could publish it anonymized, but then that's a step after you've ingested it. And,
you know, well, you could you could have something that automatically digitized disks and threw them on Internet Archive without looking at what the contents are.
Oh yeah. That's surely that has happened. The other thing about these disks is that those labels, if they're still stuck to the disk, are unreliable anyway.
Right. Unreliable narrator.
Right. It says, you know, whatever, you know, general ledger or whatever, and it's actually like letters to the mistress or whatever.
Right. Right. You know? Whose name was Ledger.
Right. And she was a general.
That's right.
She was a general. It's so weird. I used to go to, there was a cinema here in Toronto that I really used to like. It was like a whole movie theater, but it was all basically underground. And not underground like hipsters, but just underground like physically under the earth. Uh-huh. It wasn't cool. It was just low. But on weekends, they would do random movies. Like, person had bought a massive number of old VHS tapes. And they just hooked up a projector and you would go in and they would just project whatever happened to be on those tapes. Might have been movies, might have been home movies, might have been commercials, something off the TV. Who knew what? It was just like, let's watch VHS copies for like 4 hours. And people would have little paddles you could hold up. So if you didn't like what you're watching, whatever, you could say, oh, this is boring. It's okay, I see enough red paddles. Let's do something else. It was super fun. You'd never know what you were going to get. We do the same thing with floppies at Kansas Fest. Just start projecting contents of floppies.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, actually. Yeah,
it seems start pretty... booting up from random floppies. How about this one? How about this one? How about this one?
World's easiest Cancer Fest presentation. Let me tell you, I like a presentation that takes no prior work. This would be one of those.
It does seem like, you know, random VHS tapes has a higher risk of something that you didn't actually want to see. Yeah. But it is pretty fun. That is another project that I have, on deck is I have boxes of these VHS tapes. I've talked about that, I'm sure, before that. Like, I had several VCRs running in parallel, capturing, you know, TV shows as they aired in roughly the 1998 era. And now I want to get them back off those tapes. And the problem is, it's a sort of like 1x speed process.
Yeah.
So I need to get started. So
I'd be as interested in the ads and things if it's off TV. I wish old movies recorded didn't cut out the ads. I'm more interested in the ads from the 80s than the movies from the 80s.
So. Right. And if you're lucky, you'll get something like, this probably the timing doesn't work here, but something like, you know, the TV edit of Snakes on a Plane, where you get to hear about the, you know, right. All these, whatever it is, the monkey fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane.
I want to watch that very badly.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. Let's see. I guess we can probably move on to the next thing. So actually, maybe one thing I might add here that isn't related to the topic is that I've been getting really into scanning and digitizing and doing all that stuff, and I sort of forgot that I had to edit podcasts, and so the feed is quite behind. But it will get there. But so there isn't much listener feedback that I have taken note of, but I have noticed that some has come in. So next time we will have feedback to talk about, I think. Unless any of you remember something that you wanted to bring up.
Nope.
No.
Nothing particular.
Okay. Yeah. So we can probably just jump into the items of interest in news. And Carrington has the first of these. He raises his thumb in approval.
I do indeed. This is a fun site. It is not quite complete yet. It's on something called Voidstar, and it's the Tandy Radio Shack computer cassette recorder comparison. So this person is really into the CCRs, and there's, according to this photo, like at least four different models, and this site does a deep dive into the different models. It compares them, how to repair them, examples of using them. It's not fully fleshed out yet. It's going to be six parts, according to the table of contents, and some are more complete than others. So if we go over here to part two, I think it had a whole bunch of different charts kind of explaining, well, what are the various elements that make them different than others, which is great. But when you look at, say, I think there's example usage right now, isn't fleshed out as much. It's like, okay, I'm going to talk about how to use them, and here's a photo of a setup. So it's not complete yet, but I love the fact that it's just like a super deep dive into the variants of one particular thing. Like, this is great. I wish there was more of these. I have frequently looked to buy a monitor or keyboard or mouse, particularly mouse, where there's a whole bunch of versions, and if you're not super knowledgeable or you didn't have these at the time, it's really hard to tell them apart. Why do I want model A versus model B? What are the pros and cons? Floppy drives can be like that, where there could be 14 versions of floppy drive, but six of them are really the ones to get, or if you want a particular feature, you better get this other version or whatever. So I love that this person is doing this. I think it's a fantastic site. So if you are now or think in the future you might ever be interested in cassette recorders for the Tandy Model 1 et al., this would be a site to bookmark, because I think it's fantastic. I love that this person is doing this. So whoever she or he is, well done. Digging it very much. That's it.
I have to say that I never thought of these as, like, good cassette recorders, but they probably were, you know, as good as any. I think I had some sort of variant of a Panasonic one, but that there wasn't a lot of iconicness to that in the same way that there would have been with these.
But there's this whole page about the belt repair, like how to repair the belts on them. Like, it is fantastic. I love that somebody's going to the trouble of putting up this site. So well done, whoever you are. Makes me very, very happy.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be ready for next year's Septandi.
So. Exactly. Yeah, so it's fantastic. So it says voidstar.blog and then a whole bunch of other things. So we'll just have a link in the show notes. So you jump right to it. And I say, well done.
Very cool. Okay. More thumbs of approval.
big thumb.
Okay, Jack, you have finally more discussion of Fujinet.
Yes. Now, I've been away for some episodes, but I heard there's been some discussion about the fact that we were not talking about Fujinet enough. So, and I searched and I saw the past several episodes. It's not in the show notes. It's not anywhere. So, okay. I'm going to give you some Fujinet news. I actually have a Fujinet, which I don't think I had last time we spoke. Mm-hmm. I got one this summer. I haven't used it yet because I just had a really busy 5 months. So, yeah. It's right here. It's right here on my desk, just waiting to be plugged in and used. It's very nice, 3D printed case and all that. Mm-hmm. So I've got that. But apart from the news that I'm not using it, there's other news, which is that the people behind it are working on support for more platforms for this. Mm-hmm. So there are versions of this coming for the Coleco Atom, of all things, the Commodore 64, and the Apple II.
Cool.
So... So I posted a link to the Facebook group where most of the discussion is happening about this. The Apple II version, I thought that might be most interesting for you. So it uses this something called the Smart Port, which I don't know what that is exactly, but it says it's Apple II Plus or IIe with the Lyron, Yellowstone, or Soft SP card.
Yep.
And the 2C Plus and the 2GS.
Yeah, the regular 2C doesn't have it, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, this says it's the 2C Plus.
Yeah. It's basically a drive connector. So it's what you plug floppy drives into, 3.5-inch drives or a certain range of 5.25-inch drives. Or you can, I think you can use it. Am I wrong about that? I think you can use it for larger storage, but the sort of main big storage for it is 3.5-inch drive.
Okay.
So, but it's, cool. It's, you know, a way that you can communicate data back and forth.
Right. So, I mean, then obviously you won't have the sick SIO ports on the Apple II version of the Fujinet, but you'll have something. And apparently someone is asking about if there will be support for the S100 card also. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is like they've been discussing. And Tom Cherryholm says, what did he write here somewhere? Blah, 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 blah. He said, I've contacted every single person I know in the S100 community to help bootstrap such a card. And as such, everybody passed on it.
Yeah.
Oh.
So if anyone who's not an Apple II person, but is an S100 person, wants some Fujinet in their lives, you should get on this. Because I think, love the idea of Fujinet, I still just haven't used it because I haven't used a retro computer also in the past 5 months. I've just been busy.
Yeah.
Gosh darn it. So gosh darn busy.
Well, we're judging you anyway.
Yeah. Now time does go fast.
But I also have I did install a 64K upgrade into my little old Atari 600 XL, and that worked. And I have another upgrade that I'm going to install. I'm getting off track here, but you won't mind. This is the Ultimate Atari Video Circuit Board doohickey. I'm going to pull it out of its protective sheath. I'm going to ruin this static electricity.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to try and hang onto the edge. Oh, no.
Full screen jack.
Yeah.
Okay. It's in a bag, so I got to take it out of the bag.
Zoom, enhance.
So the idea with this is, Atari, in their strange judgment, they didn't always make the best video hardware circuitry, but enterprising people have done better. So this is a sort of slide-in replacement for one of the chips. So you pop that in, and then you wire up some of the things here to output somewhere else, and it's got some jumpers for different models and stuff. And
cool.
pretty slick. And I emailed the folks that I bought it from because, like, there's one set of jumper configurations that's for the 800XL and one that's for the 600XL. But the 600XL in Europe is different. And I was like, which should I use? And they helped set me straight.
Because
so.
I'm in Europe.
One of these days, I will do that. But I think before I do that and perhaps ruin my 600XL, I will for sure actually try the FusionNet one of these days.
Yeah.
So and give, give a full report to the class.
Excellent. So this the video upgrade is just, you just put it in a chip slot, in a socketed chip slot. You don't have to solder anything.
Well, you do have, you don't have to solder onto the board or anything. So it's, so it's removable in that sense.
Cool.
But then you need to, like, if you want to use the onboard monitor connector, you need to sort of like cut some jumpers and like wire some things up to this.
I think
which is what I'm going to do.
I remember something like that. Maybe for the Spectrum, or maybe it was the ZX81 or something. I forget. But there was another machine that, like, you could. I think the normal sort of RCA jack went to TV. You know, so you had
right.
like a tuner.
Yeah, it was an RF thing. Yeah.
But you could reroute the composite signal like straight to the jack. It's just you have to do a little like rewiring.
That's the thing that I've done. I've done that. I think I've done it both for an Atari 2600 and 7800 with a similar sort of, but a similar but simpler mod where you just basically you bypass the RF converter because like on the motherboard it's generating a normal sort of composite video signal and then RF encoding it.
Yeah.
And so you're sort of bypassing that to like get just a nice composite signal out. But whereas this, what this gives you actually a better signal. It's more like what's it called? The S-video. Like, so it's like an S-video signal you can get out of this, that level of quality, supposedly. Cool. So
I remember the days when people thought that was the best video you could imagine. 400, all 480p.
Yes.
Or I, maybe, I guess.
It'll never get better.
P. No, it was P for that.
Okay.
Mark in the chat, we were talking about the S100, and correctly points out like things like the Altair, Northstar, and IMSI. Yes, the S100 bus computers. I was thinking of it as the Altair, the IMSI, and then a bunch of Z80 computers that nobody can remember the name of. Like a bunch of things.
Anyway, actually, I should say one more thing about the FusionNet while I'm on it. So the version I have that came out earlier this year, this is version 1.5. Mm-hmm. There's a version of 1.6 that has a jack on the top for an external antenna. So if you find that it's not working, like you have a hard time accessing your Wi-Fi from wherever your computer is, you can stick an antenna and have a little better signal.
Or if the computer itself is generating so much, you know,
generating so much RF that it's could also be a thing.
Yeah, I think I mentioned that I had I have a mass storage card that I have in the Apple III, and it's a CFFA2, I guess, you know, so it's you know, sort of before the nice one. It was one before, but it doesn't really matter for the Apple III. You can't use the nice stuff in the Apple III. But anyway, the thing is,
it was one of their marketing slogans.
Can't use the nice stuff for the Apple III.
Can't use the nice stuff. Apple III.
But it has a CF card spot, you know, being a CF adapter. And I have the main thing is that I have little SD cards that are Wi-Fi hubs or whatever.
Oh, so there you go. Yeah.
Connect to them and get, you know, transfer data back and forth. And I thought this would be a great idea. I will put it in my Apple III and then I don't have to open it up. I can just like, you know, sort of transmit the data into it. But of course the Apple III is like a big iron enclosure. not all of the things worked as I had hoped, but
oops.
Anyway, I've seen a little bit of the sort of discussion of the development of the Apple II FujiNet interface going on in the Slack that is devoted to this, sort of Apple II community Slack. So we'll see.
I'm going to ask about the Apple III.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
Because, maybe we can give one nice thing that you can use in the Apple III.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the Apple III doesn't have a smart port, but it can use that Lyran card. And we've talked in the last couple of episodes, actually, about or sometimes recently about the big mess of wires making a sort of a clone of the Lyran card that, you know, so that you can get a sort of a modern one. Because that particular card is a little hard to get, but that's the only way that you can connect a, like some of these things like the floppy emu and stuff to a regular old slotted Apple II, like 2E and stuff. So, and, you know, who knows, the draw of getting a Fujinet device will probably, you know, drive sales of the, actually, yeah, I guess you'd get two, get two Yellowstone cards, one for the Fujinet and one for the floppy emu.
There you go.
okay. Let's see. Now, what is it? So I'm next. And I know this is news because I've seen a fair amount of activity in the mailing list and stuff about it. I don't actually know very much about the actual object, but the 4004, the Intel 4004 chip, has turned 50. And so there's a little write-up. Actually, Intel had a press release about it, and many, many news outlets sort of took that information and reprocessed it. But anyway, it's the first, what did we say, first commercially available microprocessor.
The weasel words used are first commercially available microprocessor.
Right.
And they underline first, and then they mumble commercially available.
Right.
I mean, it was a big deal, though. This was a big deal chip, but this also predates my entry into computers, like my love of computers. So it's slightly before my time. So I also am vague on it, but other than the fact that it was a big deal. Four bits, I probably where the four comes from, or one of the fours.
Well, yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's 3/4 of a megahertz. It's 4 bits. It's like, there's a lot of stuff here that seems like they weren't quite ready to put out a real microprocessor.
Right.
But
yeah, it says the 4004 emerged from a partnership between Intel and a Japanese calculator company, Busicom. So in 1969, Busicom contracted Intel. Contracted, I suppose, not contracted. It just sounds like suddenly we're all coming down Intel. With Intel.
Well, Intel inside was the other way they phrased that. But
that's right. But Busicom contracted Intel to design a microprocessor. And they had, in this particular article, this is itworldcanada.com, it just seemed like it had, you know, slightly more content than all of the many, many other instances of, hey, the 4004 turned 50 articles. And they have a little picture of the team, and they have a little picture of the print ad, you know, announcing a new era of integrated electronics. Intel delivers the 4004. They have a picture of the Busicom 141PF desktop calculator, the first device to use the 4004. So that's nice. Though actually, now I'm looking at this more carefully, all of the photo credits are Intel. So it could be that all of these things are on the official anniversary page that Intel has provided. Is that
The only thing I ever really remember about the 404, and I remember this from a book. I don't think it's Soul of a New Machine. It's some book about the development of some early computer, where I think they considered and then didn't use this chip or something. Was about the naming of the chip, and the reason it was called the 404 was it's part of a family of four different chips, and there was one person who was like the engineer of the. There was a team of people doing this, but there's one person who I think was the engineer, and he decided kind of on his own to not use Intel's naming scheme. Like Intel had a way they were doing their chips. Like the next RAM chip was going to be called the whatever. The next ROM chip was called the whatever. And this was, the idea was to name it so that you could understand this was a family of chips designed to work together. So like there was like the 4001, 2, 3, and 4. And the 4, that's why it's called the 4004. Mm-hmm. And the other three were like RAM, ROM, and a shift register, but I don't know which was which. Like whether 4001 is RAM and 4002 is shift register and 4003 is ROM. But that is the family. Because otherwise they would have been called the whatever, like the 1123, the 1902, the 11, like they would have been all over the place. And so it's kind of a marketing name, but also kind of like a really interesting move, because like the idea of families of chipsets has stayed with us since then. So it's neat that this was the origin of that kind of idea.
I don't know a thing about like how you like what its instruction set's like, or you know how it relates to any of the later Intel chips or anything. But I should learn. Like now that it's turned 50, you know, it's time. I should.
It's old enough to learn about.
That's exactly right. anyway, so you know, happy anniversary, birthday, whatever it is, Intel 4004. And yes, Intel does have a anniversary page of its own. I mean, like I think that was kind of what a lot of the news articles drew from. But it's got, you know, it's got this image of the BusyCom, you know, whatever it is, PF at 141 PF, and the print ad and stuff that that I had given IT Canada credit for or whatever it was. So also there's a 4004.com. Somebody got 4004.com. And however many years ago that was, 15 years ago, there was a, they started doing a 35th anniversary project and they're still working on it.
They should have, if they were really committed, they would have also got 4001 through 3.com,
yeah,
and made one of those link rings so they just go to each other to really show that they understand this, and then I would be impressed. As it is, I'm not impressed.
Okay. Do better.
So 4004.com. Federico Fagan, I'm presuming it's pronounced Fagan, F-A-G-G-I-N, was the lead behind it. I knew it was somebody who signed it, and this is the chip, yes. Mm-hmm. So in the lower right corner of this CPU are the initials FF.
Ah, cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's weird how, like, chip design is the kind of thing, especially nowadays, you don't have, like, a person mm-hmm. leading chip design anymore. It's, like, a massive, it's a massive number of people involved in things. And it's funny how computers, like, as we know them, things that are recognizably computers started off being items that were made, if not entirely, but out of parts that were really by a person. Like,
yeah,
this is Joanne, and she has made this ROM. I have wrought this ROM, says Joanne. Again, it's so interesting to me that it can be like a single person does a thing. That's why I'm so fascinated now when people make homebrew computers and they design their own computer. And I've always been fascinated by somebody who says, like, this is a person and they made a whatever. Like, and just hardware design is total mystery to me. And I find it very impressive. So the idea that, like, there was a team involved in this, but one person was the engineer and led it. And it's amazing to me that somebody can be like, I'm gonna make a chip.
Yeah,
like, well done.
Yeah, a lot of these things were, you know, from that time were just a person. I'm noticing that a lot, and you know, like as I'm imaging, you know, games and things, it's like it's just one name on there, you know. So cool. Okay, well, that's actually it for what we have in the news section. That's all right. We've been gone for an hour, so. We can now, I guess, go to a word from our sponsor.
My family gave me Radio Shack's portable Model 100 computer for Christmas last year. 5 built-in programs, including telephone communications. And this Christmas, it's on sale. A super gift for my son. He can take notes at college. And one for my wife, for the household budgeting. And maybe one for... Nah, nice computer. They're on sale at Radio Shack.
Save $200 now on the Model 100 portable computer, only at Radio Shack.
Let's see, where are we? Where are we looking
I was reading up a little bit about the 4004 right now, and mm-hmm. like it's not a 4-bit. It's a little late, I know. But it's not a 4-bit CPU, but it does fetch instructions 4 bits at a time because of like memory cycle timings.
Okay. Now.
Ah, okay.
This is why it wasn't the primary topic of the show. And instead, an article we hadn't read was yes. the primary topic of the show. So it shows you how low the bar is.
At BASF, we don't make the plane. We make it lighter. We don't make the lotion. We make it smoother. We don't make the dress. We make it brighter. We don't make the carpet. We make it tougher. At BASF, we don't make a lot of the products you buy. We make a lot of the products you buy better. BASF, the spirit of innovation.
And we're back. Okay, so the host's retro competing gift idea this time is something, again, that Carrington found. Carrington always finds the
I'm always finding the stuff, because I'm all about the stuff. Tell from the big pile of stuff behind me.
That's
correct. This is a circuit board coaster. I think it's cool.
And in conclusion, I think it's cool.
Well, no, it is. Like, yeah, I linked to the Canadian Etsy site, so it's saying that it's $12 and something cents, which is probably like $10 US or something. And they're little tiny snippets from circuit boards, like cut out of circuit boards, put in acrylic, made into a coaster. For scale, they have put a toy car and a tiny little plant, neither of which is helpful to tell you how big this thing is. No. So I'm assuming it's coaster-sized. What they could have done is put a mug beside it, and that would have been an incredibly useful element for scale.
Yeah. But it could have been a tiny mug. Like
this isn't like a Matchbox car or a Dinky car like a brand you would know. This is some generic car and a succulent. And a succulent could be the size of a watermelon or could be a tiny thimble, and there's no way to know. So you will get some size of coaster.
It could be like a Barbie's Dreamhouse car or
actual car. Yeah. This is a giant coaster, and that is a big redwood tree. Like, who knows? So it is some size, presumably coaster sized. You buy them one at a time, though. So if you wanted a set of four, you're buying four of them. But it's kind of neat. Like, if you were looking for a coaster, there's worse things you can have. So I say, buy it for your geeky retro friends. It is too bad you select the coaster by color, so you can't pick, like, I'd rather pick the board. Like, I want something from an S100. I would love it if you could pick particular, like, I pick like a Commodore 64, and I would know
this
A64 board was destroyed for me to set my mug down on it. That's worth $12. I might buy a dozen and give them to all my friends. So that's kind of fun. Anyway, it's a coaster. It's kind of tech looking. Mm-hmm. It's our choice for this episode.
And I guess, you know, it does sort of seem like this would have been thrown away anyway, probably. I mean, it's not like there was a board that someone said, what I need more than this computer that works is a coaster. It's just something that was thrown away. So I see that it's $12.03 Canadian. And I thought they got rid of cents. So you couldn't buy this in cash, right?
No, yes, if you want it in cash, it would cost you two more pennies. Because it would round up to 5 cents. But if you're buying it with a digital thing, with a tap, then it goes to the penny. It's just when we do cash in Canada, we round because we're not monsters.
That's cool.
And also, our pennies are not worth anything. So.
Yeah, I think there was an episode of The West Wing, as I recall, that was sort of about the issue of, like, you know, trying to get rid of pennies because it just... What's the point? And
it costs more to make a penny in Canada than the value of the penny. So we just stop. We hit that point. We're just like, we're out. That's dumb. We're not making a coin that costs us more than that coin to make.
That sounds sensible.
Yep.
Too sensible for America. Nice.
Sensible. Too sensible. Oh, sensible.
Yeah. I think that in the West Wing episode, the block was the state of Illinois because it was their president who was on the penny. And they said,
isn't
no
it everybody's
way.
President?
Well,
he was born there. I was like, what do you mean their president? You guys have your own president? Yeah. Our state elected this person.
Yeah.
President of Illinois.
Okay. So when you're done buying as many coasters as you can possibly use, you can turn your attention to eBay. And Carrington now has something to get from eBay.
This is a lovely item. It is an Apple IIc, the original Apple IIc. I prefer the IIc to the IIc Plus, to be honest. I like the built-in 5.25-inch drive. Mm-hmm. So there's a particular model of the IIc that I think is the best one to get. It's nice to keep on, but whatever. What's neat about this is it's a IIc. It is a copy of – it's the monitor. It's a copy of AppleWorks. It's a little printer. And everything is still factory sealed. And this came up – a bunch of years ago, when we first started recording, I think, like, so a whole bunch of years ago, somebody bought a new sealed Apple II and opened it up, and it made the news. Like, why would you open it up? I'm like, of course you would open it up, whatever. So you can be like that person. It'll cost you $2,800, which is a bunch of money. That's a bunch of money for a 2C. But if you wanted the experience of, I just bought a 2C, and you're old, and you got a bunch of money anyway, or you figure, what am I going to do with it? What am I going to leave it to my kids? Whatever. Then this is an opportunity for you to have that, like, release the, like, it's even got the monitor stand. I just noticed. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice collection. Like, if somebody went and bought like the whole great 2C setup, it's the one that I would want as a 2C. It's terrific. Mm-hmm. And for some reason never opened it, and then waited till 2012 or 2021, whatever,
whatever
year it is.
Whatever
it is, I'm wrong. Also rounding that.
I think Armageddon's coming, right?
Right. So, amazing. Like, this is a really nice piece. Is it worth $2,800? I don't know. How do you put a value on this? My memory is the person who bought the sealed 2C a bunch of years ago also paid like $2,000 or $2,500 for it. It was something like that. So,
because that's the price.
If you were the person who was the second bidder that time and missed out, has been eating at you, then you might want to jump on this. So,
yeah,
buy it now. You can make an offer. So maybe you can pick it up a little less. I don't know. Does it ship to Canada? So I won't be bidding against you.
Maybe that guy who is a high profile retro computing person. Maybe he enough with his, with all of his followers. Maybe he can afford to buy this and open it live on a stream.
Yep.
For the enjoyment of all.
I'm not as impressed with the Okidata printer, but whatever.
But it's color. I remember those. I remember. I never had one or anything, but I kind of remember that that seemed like a pretty neat printer to have. But
the
monitor's
not color, so the fun thing is you'll never quite know what you're going to get when you print stuff.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. That's another little element of fun.
I found an article about the prior one. Let's see if I.
Oh right. Okay. What was that? Sold
on eBay. New inbox Apple II. Never opened. And then after paying $2,600 for it, the buyer opened the box.
Opened the box.
And dun, Ken dun, wrote dun. It.
And Ken wrote it, yes.
Oh, Ken.
Yes.
That guy.
So from a member of the podcast, Ken Gagne. Yeah.
And then
so,
that buyer resealed it with glue and is selling it for $200 more.
That's right.
Excellent. So was it just the 2C or was it also the monitor and stuff? Is this actually like a better purchase? Because a couple years later, has barely gone up.
Mm-hmm. I don't
Ken,
know. Let's see.
You'll put that information, Ken? Oh, it's a photo album.
Flickr photo album. Yeah, here we are. So Dan Budiak's photo album.
Know that name?
Yeah, it looks like it looks actually very much
also
the same.
Monitor.
Yeah.
Also at Apple Works, it's the exact same system. Is that printer? No.
Yeah, I hope not.
So this makes me think that if you bought a 2C at a certain period, you got a copy of AppleWorks with it.
Yeah.
What are the odds that two fully sealed versions of the same monitor and computer box also come with a sealed copy of the same version of AppleWorks?
Yeah,
that must have been a thing you got. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Sort of bundled. Oh, yeah, I've seen this photo of him hugging it around. But
same very monitor nice. Stand too? So this is $200 more, you get a color printer.
It's funny.
Sucker, Dan, you should have waited for this one.
Yeah. It's I think I remember Sean Fahey saying that there was a bank that was giving away 2C pluses or something for opening a checking account or some sort of deal. Mm. Like, so I think there's a sort of cache of unopened 2C pluses that come from a place like that, you know, like the thing ended. Yeah.
But I can see a lot of people getting it. You open the account and you get it and you think your kid's going to want it or whatever, but then they don't want it. So people might have gotten this and not opened it because it was a free gift with opening the account. Nice thing for opening an account. My goodness.
Yeah.
I'd switch banks now if somebody would give me one of these to open an account.
That's true, yeah. So.
Anyway. And then you'd turn around and sell it on eBay.
That's right. $2,700.
I would not. I would open it up. I would have to admit, I would open it up. I love the opening experience of old stuff.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of sort of imaging and scanning and stuff like that. And I for the most part, it's been these like sort of big box games that take up a lot of space, and ultimately I just don't want to have anymore. So I want to like do the thing that I had them for and then move them on. But there was one that it was unopened, like a role-playing game kind of thing. And it's like, I thought about it for a little bit. And I thought, all right, well, I will just take a photo of the order that things were packed in the box in and, image it, get it out of here. Because, I mean, like, you know, whatever.
That's the kind of info that's nice, though, to know. Because there'll be a record of what is included in a box, but not always the order in which it was packed. Like that's the kind of info that you can learn from opening something up or should at least try to preserve, I think. So
yeah. Okay, so let's see. I have, this is now the 25 years old, the Intel 4004 gold plated brass fifth commemorative clock.
So wait, why was this made?
It was made to commemorate the 4004. And
so they gave the 4004 a clock, or they gave people who made it a clock?
They sold it as a commemorative gift.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Like they could be selling now on their website if they were smart.
Yeah, so as we celebrate the 25th anniversary of this significant achievement, we hope you share our pride. And it's like a gold clock that has in its, sort of embedded in its face, it has a chip.
Which, if you go back to that picture, that's the actual size. It was funny. There was one of the Intel sites now shows a comparison, or shows an article that was comparing the Pentium to the 4004 when the Pentium came out, to talk about how amazing the Pentium is. And it showed like how physically large it is. And it's so funny how things have we're shrinking down and down again. So I wonder at what point did we reach peak size? Because like nowadays it's like, yeah, it's got to fit in a phone.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, there's a number of these gold plated brass clocks you can get. This particular one, I think, was the cheapest that I saw for $200. But at any rate, I thought it was kind of funny that clock has now turned 25.
Right.
Okay, let's see what else.
Is there now a new clock out to commemorate that clock?
I hope so. That's what I hope, yeah.
Or did Intel put it on a chip to commemorate that clock? Seems only fair.
Okay. Yeah, I really don't have very much today, actually. This, I think, though, is really cool. It is... I don't even know. How do you pronounce this? BASF? It's a BASF.
BASF.
Yeah. Maybe that's what you just say. Is like read it out. It's like bass, but missing a segment. But it's a diskette company, right? And I think anyone who sort of was in our era has encountered this. And you know, whatever. I didn't have a particular fondness for this kind of disc. But there's something about this keychain. I don't know. Maybe I'm the only one who sees it, but I really like it. And it's got sort of a picture of a disc on the back, and it's just it's just a little acrylic keychain, but it's got the BASF logo on it. So anyway,
only reason I know it's BASF is I remember their ads.
You called the company.
I said that once. No, they maybe you guys don't remember. They were big here in Canada. Uh-huh. They were like, I think of them as a chemical company, and there was a big ad living. DuPont had this big ad for a while. Better living or better things for better living through chemistry, or better, like it was something like that. It was this weird better.
Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
For the longest time. And like, oh, better. And I remember BASF having these TV ads. They would always say, we don't make the products you buy. We make the products you buy better. And I was like, well, what does that mean? But yeah. I've always known this company. Like they had this massive ad campaign for, we don't make the things, we make the things better. So whatever they do, cool. They didn't make this keychain. They made the keychain better.
I see. Okay, so like I thought of it as primarily like a diskette company, a media company. But you're saying it's...
No, I think they were a chemistry company.
So it's like 3M or chemicals. Whatever. You know, they're not a they're not a diskette company, but they made diskettes. Actually, they also made very good diskettes. Those are the most reliable ones that I know of now. You know, if you're going to get... new in box or whatever, not yet opened box of discs, 5 1/4 inch discs.
Were they your go-to disc back in the day? Did you find the most reliable at the time as well? Or is this just now you find the most reliable?
I think I respected them at the time.
Okay.
Now I find them most reliable. But
at the time I was really into Dyson discs.
Oh yeah.
And Elephant discs. The Dyson ones were like the expensive ones I would buy. And the Elephant ones were the cheap ones I would buy. And I bought a lot of those two brands because I liked the color of the Dyson discs is wine kind of color. I was like, that's classy.
It is.
The boxes and the Elephants because it's just an elephant. It was a great ad. So I just kind of used any disc that was lying around, whatever I would get my hands on, whatever was cheapest.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what I actually don't remember what I would sort of intentionally buy, but I think it would most likely be 3M. I lived in Minnesota, That's okay. One of the M's and one of the three M's is Minnesota. So it's
I don't remember either what my preference was. I remember having ideas about that, just like I had ideas about cassette tapes. Huh. which brand was better.
And XL.
I do not remember anymore, though. But I know I had a preference, but it is forgotten.
I had Maxell because the ads blowing the person back, totally. Yeah. I remember never quite understanding metal. There was a metal switch. Is this metal disc or not a metal disc? I'm like, what does that really mean?
Chromium oxide. I don't understand it. Type 2.
I never got my head around that. I could understand cassettes, and I could understand they were different lengths. This is what I could understand.
Yep.
The rest of it was all confusing to me. I met a guy in a mall food court once who claimed to be the person who invented the floppy disk. Oh, no, invented the cassette. I don't think he did.
That seems likely.
it seems highly unlikely. It was a British guy, and it was him. I was sitting in a food court, I think on a date. I took a date to a food court is maybe the takeaway for me. This guy swooped in to save me, or more likely to save her. Uh-huh. And him, he was this old dude, and his wife, and they sat like at the table beside me, and I mentioned something, and he chimed into what I was saying because I was a loud guy, and then somehow got onto the idea that he invented the cassette, and the reason he invented it was for use in pirate radio stations because they'd be in a ship outside. Like, you had to be so far from Britain to be able to play music and not have to pay a licensing fee or something, and the records would skip, and so he invented the cassette, and I was like, this all sounds not true to me, dude. But I'm like, okay, you're an old guy. What am I going to say, no? Like, so.
So, who knows? Was his name
was
Lou?
Was his name Lou?
Maybe it was just Lou Austin's. Does it show a picture? That would be hilarious if it really was him.
Yeah. He died at age 94 this year.
Poisoned in a food court in Toronto, Canada.
Right. Let's see. The cassette tape was.
It talks about reel to reel is too big. Yeah. I remember the time thinking, well, there was more than just records, dude. Like, wouldn't you have one of those other things?
Right.
So you wanted to be portable.
Doesn't seem. Hmm. So far, I haven't read anything here about pirate radio, or whatever. But
anyway, I remember. I haven't thought of that guy in a long time.
So it talks about born in 1926 and. Some other stuff, and doesn't mention anything about meeting this weird guy in a food court.
See, weird guys come up to you in food court and make claims in the pre-Google days. You could get away with a lot of claims as an old dude.
Yeah, sure.
We're not going to get away with anything because people will have this inbuilt ability to just Google with their brains, and all the little kids will call us on our crap.
No, you didn't. You did not admit that.
I'm like, darn it. When I was your age, you could say anything in a food court and get away with it.
All right, and I guess actually the last thing that I have.
That's it?
That's all, yeah. Short show today.
But wait, I do want to say you should Google while you have your screen up there, Paul.
Uh-huh.
Look for Google, search for Lou Ottens. There's photos.
Ah, okay.
There's photos of the guy. We'll see if this matches Carrington's memory.
Oh, Carrington's memory?
Let's see.
Does he look like an old dude?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, at some point he did.
Right?
There's an article in the Guardian, I think, that has a photo.
I don't know. Of course. He looks that much look like a planet.
There you go.
Yeah, okay. Old guy.
Did
sure.
he hold a cassette like that? Yeah.
Right. Old guy.
Yeah.
Yep.
I don't remember. Could be that guy.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the thing is, it was probably a little while before this photo was taken.
Yes. So, I don't know.
Okay.
I may never have met... It's like BASF. You don't meet the guy who made the stuff. You meet the guy who made the stuff up.
Do you recall the guy having a Belgian accent? Because he's from Belgium.
No, he had a British accent.
Okay.
Yeah.
Remember, he was definitely
that can
a
be learned.
Brit. He sounded English.
Okay.
All right. So my last thing, this is nothing. I put it in the show notes as a joystick with a face.
Looks like a bird.
Yep. So it's a Genius joystick model J12 for the PC, and it just struck me as like looking like a little robot of some sort.
It has a face.
Strangely ergonomic.
It looks like a duck or a bunny rabbit, depending on which angle you're thinking of it.
Yep.
It looks like a Star Wars ship, maybe, but I don't see the face.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking. It looked like a little animal, but like this little thing is its eye. That's its nose.
It's like looking at a cloud, though. It's like, I guess
you could also say maybe it's got a face down here.
Is it one of those things where I have to squint and unfocus my eyes and I can see a sailboat? It's a schooner! Right.
Anyway, so for $28, you can get a joystick that looks like a whatever, Star Wars ship or a bird or who knows what.
It's like looking at a cloud.
It's a joystick that's like looking at a cloud. So, anyway, okay, yeah. There was a time, actually, you know, before I joined the podcast, when the normal amount of eBay auctions one would bring would be one. Occasionally, yeah. Two if one was extravagant. So,
but you put an end to that, didn't you, Paul?
So I'm bringing us back to our roots.
Well, I think back when I started, when I joined this, most people were showing one, but Paul was being exceptional and showing more than one thing most of the time.
Yeah. Anyway.
And I'm sticking mostly at zero.
When I joined this, eBay didn't exist.
That's right. We ran that podcast on 4,000 floors
in a food court.
Okay. Well, yeah, see, that's the good thing about having cassette tapes, right? I mean, like, you invent the cassette tape so that you can then record a podcast.
It is pitch black to your friends. Where you are, Paul.
Yeah.
What's happening?
Look. what are you doing?
When I actually use my eyes and look out the window, it is just as dark as it looks like on the camera.
That's crazy.
But, well, I mean, you are farther east. You're in the same time zone, but you are farther east by hundreds of miles, right?
Yeah.
I thought Boston was a little bit south, or a little bit east. Is it that far east?
Oh. It's on the East Coast.
That's true.
But Canada goes way out there. Canada's sneaky that way.
Yeah.
We pushed our coast out to the edge.
But you're only in one place. You're not the whole way out yourself.
I'm all of Canada. You can't see otherwise, you hoser. Take off.
Okay. Brandon, who is helping us by adopting the podcast today, tells us that Toronto is 8 degrees further west, but only 1 degree further north.
Ah, okay.
So it adds up. Makes sense.
It all makes sense. Also, Jeremy indicates that he invented food courts. We didn't invent the food. We invented the,
we made
the court
it
to eat it.
Yeah. I didn't invent the food you're having today, but I'm going to eat your french fries. BASF.
Something like that. Okay. Anyway, we have made it to closing discussions. And
whew.
So, Carrington, do you have any parting shots, thoughts?
I continue to play with and enjoy my iMac G4, which I'm pointing at. Can't see it on screen, but it's right to the right of me. It's delightful. It's one of those things where I agonized over the purchase, and I thought I would use it for a short time and then get rid of it because the burden of having things. But I love it. I have learned if you pick the right retro computer, you can enjoy it. Like, so much. I use it all the time. I adore it. The keyboard's terrible. The mouse is terrible. But the computer is wonderful.
So. Cool.
That's it. I've been playing games on it still. All the time. I love it. I've been playing Harry the Handsome Executive again. It's so hard. It's so good.
Yeah.
I like the game.
I love the concept of that game. It's such Harry such a very funny executive. Idea.
I don't know this. What is it?
It is a game. It's a top-down action game where you play Harry, handsome executive. It takes place in offices, and he's in a chair, and he can kick and move himself backwards, and you attack things. You got to go through mazes, basically, and you can bang into pop machines, and it'll spit out a Pepsi can. You can then throw at people, like shake it up and throw it, and it explodes, and you have staplers to shoot, and it's great. You mostly just move. It's great.
Yeah.
It's a delightful game. I'm at a point where it's very difficult. But it's great. I love it. So I've been playing a lot of that.
Sounds good.
I really just the mechanic of like sitting in a chair and like kicking yourself to move backwards is just the funniest.
It's great. It's fantastic. My friend Mark and I used to do a thing called Egg for a while, which was a zine. I made a zine called Egg, and I used to print it at a print shop my family had that I would have access to at night. So I was at the time in Western, which is London, Ontario, so like 2.5 hours west. I would lay out in Cork, usually, because all the zines should be put up in Cork. I'm such a poser, so I would lay it out in Cork. And then I would get it ready to print on a disc, and then I would drive at night 2.5 hours and let myself into the print shop where I could print everything out on the digital printers there because it was cheap. I might be a poser, but I'm also a cheap poser, so good combo. And my friend Mark and I, in fact, I think Colin did as well. So the three of us were there one night, 2 a.m, printing out my stupid zine to print the next day. And we realized that there was a path through this entire building. Like, you could go through the offices, into the art department, through all where the cameras are, through paste up, back through the prints, like, and make a track through the whole thing. And of course, then racing ensued. So we get in the chairs, and we're just kicking backwards and racing around this thing, not realizing we're so much heat. We are burning the carpet, like, not just leaving marks on the carpet. We're like melting the plastic, I guess. And so did a lot of damage that night, is what I'm saying. We looked afterwards like, oh no, we've trashed this place. Oops.
Interesting. So, interesting.
Yeah. So that's my Harry the Hand suit executive moment.
Nice.
Very cool.
So careful out there, kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, Jack, you're next. Any sort of closing thoughts?
Oh, wait, there's a question.
Like, I was not coughing to try and interrupt and take a place.
There's a question in the about my, yes, I got a new, other new thing. I got my record player has changed. Mm-hmm. I got a 1971 Apollo. It's made by Electrohome. It was made in Kitchener, so right here in Ontario. We used to make electronics, and that thing there is a record player. The dome lifts up, and it's got a record player in it.
That's
and it's got
cool.
a stacker, so I can put more than one record on, and it drops them and plays one side of the records. And it's got these round point here speakers sit below. Mm-hmm. It is a delight. It is just, it's one of my dream record players. I think called Welltron, but they go for $4,000 or $5,000. So no, thank you. And this thing, somebody was selling it locally and I'm like, I would love one of those. So
that's really
I
cool.
Absolutely nice. Adore it. It is just wonderful. Has a radio in the front and it's just, yeah. Post a couple of pictures on Instagram if you want to see a close up there. It's great. I assumed I got it really, really cheap and I assumed I would have to repair it. And instead it works perfectly. And the person had even put a brand new needle in it. I'm like, oh, thank you. That's great.
Electrohome cool. record player. It's Electrohome, you said.
Yes. Electrohome. Yeah, it was called the Apollo, named after the Apollo moon landing. So it was that whole space age thing. Let's make a space age looking record player. There were a couple of different versions. This one's the 711, I think it's called. It's the one with the radio built in. There's ones that don't have a radio as well. So this is the one with the radio in the front.
I like it. I like it. It's
I nice. Adore it. It is great. It is just a thing of beauty. I got a couple other, he gave me some other stands for the speakers if I want them higher, but I like where they are, and a spare dome. So I have two domes. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do any of that. But it's great.
Well, you just love it. Wear one.
Of course. It's better to listen. So yes, it is an Electrohome Apollo record player.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I'm in sort of in the market for one. So for a record player. So that's, and they all look the same except for that one. So
yes. Yeah. Most of them look the same. I wanted something minimalist before, but then when this came up, I was like, I will get rid of my record player and I will buy this. I would love to have this. So I am absolutely loving it. Yeah.
Cool.
And all its 1970s goodness.
Electrohome made a monitor for the Apple III too. That's the other thing I know of Electrohome.
Oh, cool. The Super Grover in the chat is saying has a bunch of Electrohome TVs. Yeah, I'm a fan of Electrohome stuff because it's like a Canadian brand where a lot of their stuff was made in Canada.
Cool. Yeah. I made a sort of like a whatever fist of solidarity into the air.
Canada.
Yeah. Okay, Jack, what do you got?
Yeah.
I don't have too much of anything. Nothing, very little retro related. I've just been like, the Fujinet I haven't used, the Ultimate Atari video I haven't installed. Oh God, and I still have the Ultimate 1 MB I haven't installed either. All the things I can do to potentially ruin this 600XL of mine. But
you'll get there. Someday you'll get there.
At some point I'll get off my butt and do these things. I've just been busy with life, which is why I've been absent so much all the time also. But good to see you all again.
And you have a nice Weeble chair.
What's that?
You have a nice Weeble chair.
Yeah, have you guys noticed me moving all the time? I've got this chair. I told the guys before we started, I've got this chair that does not stand firmly. So the idea is you have to keep your feet on the floor. I feel like I'm working my core. You know, I think that's what they call it. I'm working my core by having my legs required to hold me up some of the time.
You do seem more ripped at the end of the show than the beginning. So
yeah,
I think it's working, Jack.
I can feel the energy coursing through me as we go.
Nice.
So the chair is like a Weeble Wobble. It's very heavy in the bottom, so it won't tip over. And then
at some point, though, during some future episode, you're just going to go. And I am here for it. You're just going to fly backwards when you lose control. It's going to be great.
Like, it's got a... Here, actually,
so people can walk up to you and push you, and you won't actually fall over.
But you won't fall down.
So challenge accepted. It's heavy though. I'm gonna try and show this to you on.
Oh, okay.
So it's like this.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, I was anticipating something completely different.
I thought it was going to be sort of egg-shaped or something.
I thought it was going to be the egg, too.
Not actually egg-shaped, but the weight distribution is like a Weeble Wobble. So this bottom end is super heavy and like rubbery and grippy, so it doesn't slide around. You can tilt forward maybe not 45 degrees. You can tilt forward pretty far and
show us how far, Jack. Yeah. Show us how far you can tilt.
This is how far before I fall.
Okay, I'm quite far back now.
Farther? Farther? This is going to be great, folks. This one's for you, Brandon. Farther?
Okay, right there. It started sliding. Okay.
All right.
I think it's partly on a rug. But anyway, it's pretty intense. And I've got to keep track of what's going on here. And if I sit too long in certain positions, some parts of me go all tingly in a way that I don't want. And so it's like, that's why I'm sometimes like, oh, God, I got to move
tingly in the way that you do don't want.
That's a whole different kind of chair that I didn't
buy. Okay, whole different kind of podcast. Okay. Okay, Jack. So can I ask you a question about the things on your wall behind you? Because now you've exposed this. So there's two of them, but those are not guitars, right? You're not like a giant of a man. Those are like
no.
little things, ukuleles.
That's one
it's
ukulele.
Next to this giant coaster.
It's another ukulele. So this is a ukulele. This is one I bought this summer. So I'm much more doing music stuff than retro things. I bought this from a guy in Nicaragua who sells them. His name is... Luis Pilarte. It's nice. Right there. So it's kind of nice. I usually get factory made kind of stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. We're also, as we all do, we don't have artisanally crafted laptops. But it's kind of nice to have this thing that is like, this
you
guy
don't.
Made it and he was like sending me pictures while he was doing it and stuff. And it's cool.
So a person
nice.
Who makes guitars is called a luthier, right?
Luthier.
Yeah.
Same for ukuleles.
And so, same thing for ukulele? Okay.
Yeah. And I think this guy makes both also. So a lot of people make...
And what makes a ukulele a ukulele? I saw it has four strings.
Yes.
So if it had six, would it just be a tiny guitar?
Yeah, in theory. Well, it's also how it's tuned. So like a guitar, the strings from top to bottom are at a low pitch to always ascending upwards to a higher pitch. And this doesn't have that. It has what's called reentrant tuning. So the top string is actually a higher pitch than the one right below it.
Weird.
Oh.
Which
That's
means
very
so
weird.
Like...
So
the
you
top
have to retrain
string
yourself
note
entirely.
Is the same as playing the third fret on this string. So it's kind of weird. If you're playing chords, it doesn't really matter because you had the shapes in your fingers. Mm-hmm. So it's more if you're playing melodies, it gives you different sort of options and different ways of doing it. So
the shredding is entirely different.
Shredding is totally different.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very cool.
So that's
cool.
What I've been doing. Yeah. Oh, and I've actually been, this is also retro in a sense, but not computing. I've been taking guitar lessons to learn how to play old jazz.
Online or in person?
In person. I found a guy here in Stockholm, an American.
You're not afraid to be around people? I'm still not doing a lot of in-person stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not doing a lot either. But this is one-on-one. I'm not too worried about it. Mm-hmm. So far, I haven't gotten sick. And it's pretty fun to just sort of like, I took guitar lessons when I was 15 or something for a few weeks, and then I've never taken a lesson again, just like self-taught. And so it's kind of fun to actually be, it's like being back in school in a sense, like getting like homework, and it's all very one-on-one. He's like, okay, what have you done what have you done last week? Okay, here's stuff to try out next week.
Mm-hmm. Have you been able to tell from the reaction that you have developed a lot of really bad habits being self-taught and they're trying to correct them?
Not really. Not as much as I thought, actually. Oh, well, that was my concern also. That was my concern about most of what I've been playing is like rock, blues, punk, that kind of thing, and not more the way it's done in jazz. And so, he can do all that stuff too. Obviously, he's been playing guitar since before I was born, I guess. But it's not his area of interest. But he's very much like, he's like, yeah, okay, I can see why you're doing that, but here's a different way. How about trying it this way instead? So...
Kay's also doing jazz piano. I find it weird that so many people who get very good at instruments seem to all want to go off and play jazz. It's like they're sick of playing music that people enjoy listening to, and they want to go do stuff that musicians like. And I was like, what's with jazz, man?
Well, so and for me, the interest in jazz has mostly risen concurrently with my interest in swing dancing. And ooh, then you're dancing, you know, primarily to like swing era jazz from the 1930s, right, 40s, that kind of thing. Like the newer stuff, like modern experimental jazz, is not really my cup of tea.
See, when people say jazz, I assume they mean make it up as you go jazz.
Yeah, and that's not what I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. At least not at this point. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
In 10 years, maybe I'll be one of those people. I don't know.
But alone.
At this point, I'm much more like towards this kind of, you know, the melodic side of things and like the okay, feeling and the you know, the movement of the music rather than wanting to cool, like experiment with atonality and blah blah blah.
That's cool.
Retro Paces with yeah, another retro jazz roundtable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I briefly in, I guess it was high school. I was in, you know, whatever the band. But
oh, wait, because you guys were in a band together, weren't you?
We were in college. Yeah,
I'm pointing at you two right now.
Yeah, but in high school there was a Dixieland band, and they had no banjo player. So I,
okay.
I,
oh, what a shame.
So I was the I played the banjo part on a guitar. Nice. On an electric guitar. It was
because the ukulele wasn't available.
It was really weird though. I mean, because it had a lot of these, you know, like actual like musician chords and things, you know, with right, diminished ninths and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. I also had a similar experience in high school where like our school had a jazz band, and I was a percussionist in school, so I was in the school orchestra and band and marching band and all that stuff, and I liked what I was doing and everything, and I had been starting to play guitar. And I asked our band director, like, well, can I try this in the jazz band? And he was like, yeah, okay, why not? Like, he's very much someone who's very into jazz and very interested in it. And he let me try, and I was in it for a year and a half, or maybe two whole years. And, yeah, the same thing with, like, what is this, like, diminished ninth chord, flatted fifth? Like, I didn't know what any of it was. I was just completely lost on many of the songs. Some of them were straightforward, and some were just like, and, like, I just had no resources. You know, nowadays it's pretty easy to find, like, you know, go online and see how to play different things and download sheet music and, you know, all these things. But as a teenager in rural Minnesota with nobody around and I didn't know where to find books on the topics or anything, just like I was lost. I sometimes went to contact my old band director, Brian Kozer, and say, Brian, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I ruined it.
It's a little bit freer style jazz than was intended. Excellent.
So what about you, Paul?
Yeah.
What is new in Paul Land?
I have been spending a lot of time scanning things. I've got, I've been getting the little applesauce device, you know, imaging floppies and scanning things. I have a little scanner running. It's takes a long time to do that, but it's, you know, it's kind of nice to actually get through these things. I have not been spending a lot of that time editing podcasts, as I discovered as the next recording came up, and I thought, oh, geez, I still have two left. So soon there's going to be a big, you know, a big marathon of RCR for people on the feed to listen to. But anyway, but yeah, it's been fun. It's been interesting. I haven't used that much, you know, actual retro hardware, except that I do occasionally like stick in a disc to see, like, when the imaging's not going well, I'll stick in the disc in my little 2+ here to see if it actually boots. But
So when you say scanning, you mean physically scanning like books and periodicals, or do you mean scanning discs?
Well, basically like the what I'm starting with is sort of like the big SSI games and, you know, like stuff that had a big box and a bunch of manuals and stuff. So I'm scanning all the manuals and stuff, and as I also flux the disc. So
I was going to ask. So it's you're flexing them. That's how you're preserving the discs.
Yeah. Okay. So the idea is basically I'm addressing these things as if I will not have them in the future and cannot do this again. Because, in fact, I'm sort of intending not to have them in the future and not to be able to do this again.
Well, ideally you want to do it that way because that means hopefully you only do it once. You say, okay, look, I flex the disk. I've scanned it the best resolution I can.
Right.
This is now a problem for a future person. This is as good as I could have gotten.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Because it drives me crazy when I look at some scans of old things and they're like relatively low resolution JPEGs. And I think, oh, that was so much work. And it's like illegible and needs to be redone.
Right. Yeah.
But that makes me think about what people might say in the future, 100 years from now. Like, oh, yeah, great. Paul Hagstrom scanned all these things, but he didn't notate like the thickness of the box. He didn't do a materials analysis of what the paper was made of.
Right.
We can't properly print one of these things in our Insta print machine because we don't know exactly what it was made of. It won't smell right.
Yeah. That's right, exactly.
That's an interesting thing, though, but you could give weights, though. If you had dimensions and weights, people would be able to calculate a lot of that.
Yep.
You could say, stick all the stuff on a scale.
Yeah.
You should be weighing everything.
Everything weighs.
Weighing and measuring.
0.1 pounds.
But you should weigh everything by you holding it, getting on a scale, and then people have to also look at your journals, like, how much did Paul eat at this time? Yeah. We're going to say the combo of Paul plus this box lid means the box lid is this.
I think there was,
they can recreate Paul in 3D.
I think there was an experiment of some sort that was designed to figure out like how much the soul weighs. You know, a similar kind of thing.
Right.
You know, like you weigh somebody right before they died and right after.
Which sounds like it sounds like a fun thing to stipulate in your will.
Yeah.
Like you make a living will. So like when I'm actually dying, when I'm actually, you know, when they've decided, okay, this guy's just about a goner, weigh me. Wait till the moment. Weigh me again. Yeah. For science.
Yeah, for science. That's exactly what it is. But anyway, yeah, so it's been interesting with going through this stuff. And it's actually been kind of cool to have a reason to start my 2 plus here. So I realize, so I'm, you know, whatever, setting up this area, and I have the 2 plus I have right next to me is it's a Bell & Howell, you know, black sort of fancy 2 plus. And it actually has a sort of a history too. It's the original owner of it, sort of, I think he may have actually gotten it from Apple, and he's like was a columnist for Soft Talk magazine and stuff like that, you know, so sort of like has a known provenance. But the keyboard doesn't work. You know, like some of the keys do not actually respond. So like I can test things out to the extent that I can see if they boot, and if I can get further in the process by typing numbers, then I can do it as long as it's not a couple of them. But, you know, otherwise, so that's one of the things I need to do is try to figure out how to get these keys working. And one downside of this being, you know, the sort of special edition Apple II Plus is that it has a pretty rare keyboard. I mean, like it's got black keys, it's black sort of like shiny keys, like a typewriter. And so it's not easy. Like, I'm really hoping I can get this actual keyboard to come back to life, because I don't want to put a different keyboard in there.
And is there any worry that like you'll flex something and then test your duplicate on the Bell & Howell and it doesn't work, and back of your mind says, is this just not compatible with the Bell & Howell versus like a different Apple II?
Yeah, it's conceivable, but actually that question went a different direction from where I thought it was going. There are a couple of discs that in the process of fluxing them, I have rendered them unusable.
Oh,
which is not great. You know, I can see it. I flux it once, there's an error, and I think, I need to do it again. Flux it again. Now there's two errors. flux it again.
I can see the light through it now. Oh goodness.
So, all right. Well, you know, it happens, I guess. Another disc, actually, I was just working on earlier today. I was fluxing it, and it was just, you know, it's not coming out right. And you know, I looked at the sort of visualization of the disc, and it's essentially off center, right? Like, so the tracks are sort of, you know, they're missing. So I would try to, and I thought, well, maybe the disc's not centering in the drive right. And so I would, you know, pull it back and then put it in and slam the drive down to try to like catch it in a centered position. It turns out, my conclusion is at this point, it was mastered off center. Like,
wow.
The drive it's sitting just fine on the drive. I can read the other side just fine. But in the factory, the thing that laid the tracks down initially was not centered.
But was it off so much it wouldn't be usable?
Yeah, it doesn't boot in my real hardware, and I can't image it. You know, so I think I have faithfully reproduced this useless disk. But
well done.
Yeah. Congratulations to me. And of course, you know, when I went out and looked on the internet, you know, I don't think it's a protected disk, and I think, you know, there's a perfectly good image of it out there already. So, whatever. But I got a story to tell on a podcast.
Yeah. Exactly. There you go.
All right. I also noticed that I'm sitting in a chair that squeaks a lot now.
But doesn't
chair
wobble.
Rocks.
Doesn't wobble.
Yeah.
Squeak and wobble.
Jazz chair rocks.
Yeah. Indeed.
I mean, it jazzes.
Yeah. All right. I think we've made it. I think we have reached the end. Somehow we still took 2 hours to do half the stuff.
Almost no content, but still filled a huge chunk of time.
All right. So that is it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Carrington has moved off screen. He's danced his way all the way across and is providing jazz hands in honor of our discussion of jazz. So, where were we? I think we were writing a review on iTunes that may help people find the show. And until next time,
Retro-compute.
Cool.
Perfectly timed.
Yep.
Working on
it. Yeah, I really do like that record player.
It's awesome. Investigated. Highly recommended. I love it. I love it so much. There's another one called a Welltron. Very similar sort of idea. The UFO on a pedestal. But those are a lot more expensive.
Yeah. That seems like not something I need. But because, I mean, the thing is, I have a bunch of records. But I'm probably going to play them just enough times to digitize them, and then it's over. You know, so this,
I really
so
enjoy
something
it. I
art.
Really enjoyed getting back into records.
Yeah.
The upside, I like the tactile experience. I like, in the same way, the same reason I like physical media. Like, I like if I'm going to sit on the couch. Oh, I hate this couch so much. But if I was to sit on a couch, a better couch, and like read a book, and I put on music, and I really like it. I like holding the album. I love everything about that. I forget how short a side of a record is.
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
Super annoying.
So getting something like this that has a stacker that you can put a few up and play all the side A's of like five records is a major time saver. It's like, I didn't realize. As a kid, it never bothered me, but this it's so fast. It's like, here are your three songs. Okay, get up again.
Yeah.
That's it?
Well, we were much fitter back then because we had to keep getting up.
I guess. Get up all the time.
Well, I can't remember. Talked about this before. Did we talk before about the thing with the pre-LP, the way that music was distributed on records?
Pre-LP.
That, like, so, like, mm-hmm. so the, oh, the,
like
the name
albums.
Album.
Yeah.
Yeah, the album comes from. You had like a little photo album of 45s.
Oh, of things, right, yes.
Yeah. And you would dump them all out and put them all in one thing on a thing with a changer, and it would play them song after song. So you would play that whole stack. Lift it up, flip that whole stack over, or play them all again.
Yep.
And that's why an album is called an album, because it used to be like a photo album. You'd have your 45s in for a record, for an album.
Yeah, that's cool. So when a record drops down on another one, does that it feels to me like that's a scratch risk, isn't it? Okay.
I don't concern myself with that. I suspect it is for people that are really concerned about, like, people who think that albums sound better than other things will be concerned about that. People like me will go, whatever, it's pops whatever. And crackles, and I just like the music.
Yeah,
I'm not concerned at all.
And I think that old school thing when it was the 45s, like records are always thicker. The middle, that middle center ring is thicker than where the grooves are.
Uh-huh.
And on a 45, that middle ring is so much more of the surface area.
I see.
You know, compared to on an album, so it's like
so they don't touch.
Most of the weight is like definitely in the middle, hitting the middle. So yeah, if there's dirt. That dirt's going to get compressed in there somewhat, but like there's small gaps between where the grooves are anyway.
That's what I've been surprised at is I can put like four albums or four records on there, and they're all falling on top of each other. So the fourth one's just on a stack of records, and yet they still spin fine. I would have thought it'd be slipping or something because they're not on the mat, but just a stack of four or five will just spin fine and just plays okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think it's probably because that middle part is flat enough and heavy enough that like that mass sticks it together, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's enough inertia that all stick and hold, and it's fantastic.
Cool. Good thing we ended the podcast, you know, and then...
Yeah.
Just keep on talking.
Some time ago.
We just keep on talking. It's fine.
Yeah, that's cool. We're a horse and chain.